I'd like to thank Donna for organizing this session while she's still officially on maternity leave, and all the other work she's been doing lately while on maternity leave. And then I have some more acknowledgments at the end of the my presentation. And I actually trimmed this presentation down some yesterday, but for some reason I just had so much I thought I wanted to cover. It's still really long, so I will probably be talking really fast, which I do anyway. So the four topics that I'm going to talk about today are, the first one is just some key terms involved with my talk's subject, which is the confidentiality and security of data when using a GIS. Then I'm going to talk about some small cell rules and their history, and then talk just a little bit about geospatial methods for protecting sensitive data. And even though that's where my background is, in geospatial and geography, that's actually the section that got trimmed down the most. That happens to me all the time. And then finally, I'm going to get to the HCSB's HIV data release policy. So Donna and I are in a work group that's revising and updating this policy. And so there's a lot of interest in our division to really talk about that here at this meeting. And so I didn't really cut any of that out. And in discussions with colleagues, I often find, in discussions about security and confidentiality with my colleagues, I often find that the terms security and confidentiality are used interchangeably and together. So I just wanted to start at the basic level and define these terms because I use them throughout the presentation. So first of all, you can think about privacy as being the individual's right to control the acquisition, use, and disclosure of their identifiable health information. Secondly, we have confidentiality, which concerns privacy interests that arise from specific relationships of trust, for example, between the doctor and patient, or researcher and subject. And third, the concept of security, which is the technological and administrative safeguards and practices designed to protect data systems against unwarranted disclosure, modification, or destruction. And I'd like to thank Pat Sweeney and Sam Costa for that particular slide, and I think probably a lot of you know them for doing some security and confidentiality training with HIV and STD. The context for conversations around security and confidentiality can be found in a lot of this background information. So there are federal, state, and local laws and regulations, for example, the HIPAA that was enacted in 1996. Also, we have, with the CDC, states, and other partners, we have policies and procedures for confidentiality, security, and data release. And then we have data sharing agreements with the CDC, with other health departments possibly, or indefinitely within other divisions at the CDC. We also have ethical standards and principles that provide some of this context, and security again, the technological standards, and finally training to develop and maintain a culture of privacy. So this training might take place through CDC or in the health departments or in other arenas. And at DHAP, we have our own set of resources that we use related to security and confidentiality. And you might be familiar with some of these as well. So there is the CDC and our sister agency, ATSDR, Policy on Releasing and Sharing Data. There's another policy that was developed with the agency and our colleagues at CSTE on data release guidelines for re-release of state data. Then there's the revised HIV/AIDS surveillance guidelines that deal particularly with security and confidentiality. And finally, there is you might be familiar with this acronym, I'm not sure, but it's the center that the Division of HIV and STD are part of, NCHHSTP, has a work group on guidelines for security, confidentiality, and data sharing. And this is actually a work in progress right now. At DHAP, we also refer to guidelines and standards established by our colleagues at NCHS, or the National Center for Health Statistics, wherein geographic places and characteristics of areas with less than 100,000 people are not to be identified. And so that's a pretty large number, and we'll get back to that. Usually, this is done by aggregating the data to a certain geographic area. In the United States, the most common areas used are the county, the census tract, or the five-digit zip code. And you'll see I've got a resources list at the end, and there's at least a half dozen references from NCHS because they've done a lot of work in establishing these standards. The next topic is talking about how to prevent disclosure using tabular data suppression. So, start off with talking about what is suppression. When it's not possible or desirable to create a table with small numbers as numerators or denominators in cells, then cell suppression is used. So suppression is a method of disclosure limitation used to protect individuals' confidentiality by not showing or suppressing the cell values in tables of aggregate data for cases where only a few individuals are represented. And this is referred to as primary suppression or primary cell suppression. So in other words, primary cell suppression is used to withhold the data, the numerator values, in the cell which failed to meet the threshold. And this may be followed by complementary or secondary suppression of other cells in order to avoid inadvertent disclosure through back calculation. So I have a real simple example to show what I mean by this, and I'm pretty sure I took this slide from Donna. I have a mentor who says genius deals, and so I've got slides throughout all my presentations from other people. So this simple example, if you look at the cell in the upper left corner, which would be blacks aged 0 to 34, if it did not meet this whatever the threshold that was set for data release, it would be suppressed. And then, as you can see, that means that secondary suppression would be needed for three other cells. And this illustrates why cell suppression is often a method of last resort due to the side effect of complementary suppression. So you end up losing a lot more data than just that one cell. And then there's also a lot of manual labor necessary to implement the method. So even though, you know, everything today is automated and you can write scripts and SAS programs to do this, it really does take a lot of manual work just to make sure that you're suppressing what needs to be suppressed. In terms of small cell data suppression rules, there are three categories in the literature, and you're probably familiar with these. Numerator rules, denominator rules, or a combination of both numerator and denominator. And there's problems with, there's pros and cons to all of these types of rules. And an example of who's using what type of cell suppression rule comes from a Delter et al. Article. And this paper presents the results of a survey that assessed the use of GIS within STD programs and how programs are currently addressing confidentiality issues. So as you may be aware, this survey was distributed to all STD project directors in late 2004. And the project areas were asked a series of questions related to the confidentiality rules they applied to all types of STD data. And as you can see from this map, there were a variety of rules that were applied. You know, you have no cell suppression applied, and you have numerator rules, denominator rules, as well as a combination of the two, as I mentioned a minute ago. And as they found in this article, Delter et al., the rule of five is the most common, but they also found that the rule of five, the definition of that, varied. So it could mean to certain states, 0 to 5, 1 to 5, 1 to 4, or 0 to 4, all fit into that definition of five. So that complicates the matter even further. In addition, these rules were applied at a variety of scales. So the rule could be applied at the zip code level, the census tract level, and or the block group level. The statistical working paper 22 is frequently cited by other agencies as well as throughout the literature regarding cell suppression and data release methods. And so the work group that Donna and I are part of, we did a massive amount of literature review and everybody referred back to this one paper, which is why I mentioned it here. And what they found is that some agencies require at least 5 respondents in a cell while others require 3. And again, the primary suppression rules most commonly used to identify sensitive cells by government agencies were an N rule or the denominator rule, a K rule or a numerator rule, or something that's referred to as a P percent rule, which is the proportion rule. So we started to hear a lot of the same information. And as a member of the DHEP work group on data release policy and as the geospatial person, I reviewed a lot of the geographic literature surrounding today's topic. And I would like to share some of my findings on this literature, but as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it's a lot briefer than it was 12 hours ago. So first of all, these are the methods for protecting sensitive data geospatially. So I've talked about data cell suppression in tables. these are the methods that geospatial scientists use. You can aggregate spatially, which means in a geographic unit. So you start with point level data, you can aggregate to the census tract or up to the county level or even up to the state level. You can aggregate temporally, which means, of course, a time span of 2, 3, 5, however many years that are needed to ensure confidentiality. You can create a density smooth surface, which is also referred to as smoothing, and you might have heard that term before. And I would actually guess that some of the presenters that follow me might have some examples of that. You can remove contextual information, so road networks or other geographic items that might identify where your place is. And then some more sophisticated methods that I really don't have. This is definitely not the time, don't have the time to get into them, but you can also manipulate the data in some way to make it a little less likely that people could re-identify the cases. So data rotation, displacement, or perturbation. As I mentioned with tabular cell suppression, though, there are problems with those types of methods. There are also problems, you know, with these geospatial methods as well. For example, with aggregation, the problem invariably will be the in terms of aggregating spatially, the choice of geographic unit to use, or if you're going to aggregate temporally, the time period to use. So there are also, you know, other there's elements to keep in mind if you're going to use these geospatial methods. Leitner, Curtis, and others at LSU have conducted a lot of research, both theoretical and applied, looking at these methods of geomasking the data that I just mentioned. In this 2006 article, they identified geographic methods that preserve both the confidentiality and the visual characteristics of your data. And the methods that they deemed best for geographic masking, and if I remember correctly, they looked at 7 different methods. The 2 methods they thought were the best were aggregating point locations at the midpoint of a street section or aggregating the point locations at the closest street intersection. And again, this is relevant to the data they were looking at. So this might not be the best method for HIV data or other STD data that's a lot more sensitive. Another factor influencing the display of confidential personal data is considering your audience. So who's going to be looking at these maps? And I thought that was a really interesting thing to think about. So for publication purposes, journals, reports, or books, the personal information needs to be spatially manipulated. So some of those more sophisticated methods that I mentioned briefly might need to be applied. For public presentations, so to concerned locals, local area politicians, academia at conferences, et cetera, less vigilance is needed. They feel that even individual residences, randomized slightly, can be displayed, unless, of course, you're giving handouts. And then for local experts in the field who will actually act on the findings of these maps, the data should be presented as accurately as possible so that response and mitigation strategies are employed. So in other words, no manipulation strategies should be applied for that particular audience. My last topic here is this whole, you know, reviewing HCSB's HIV data release policy. So the current data release guidelines were developed jointly by the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at CDC and the CSTE. And to develop these guidelines, each state epidemiologist selected the geographic level at which CDC may report data on HIV/AIDS cases residing in that state. These agreements were last updated in 1995, when HIV infection reporting was not conducted in all areas. Therefore, these release agreements were limited to AIDS case data. As of April 2008, all U.S. states, D.C., and U.S. dependencies have instituted the same confidential name-based system of reporting for HIV as AIDS. Therefore, by the end of 2012, it is anticipated that the most recently transitioning jurisdictions will have sufficiently mature systems to include both HIV and AIDS case data in a public information data set. With that in mind, Pat Sweeney, who again, a lot of you are probably familiar with, and she's our data security and confidentiality guru, she organized a work group to begin discussions about reviewing and updating the current HCSB data release policy. And the current policy, she wanted me to mention, is to suppress a numerator of three or fewer. So that's where we started. This work group was formed in response to questions that were raised regarding application of the rules for cell size restriction and presentation of data as part of the revision process for the HIV-AIDS surveillance report. So they've been working on revising the HIV-AIDS surveillance report, and it was just kind of part of that whole process. In this initial work group report, we present a summary of the current data release policy, a literature review on the topics of data confidentiality, threshold rules, and privacy issues related to spatial data, which is pretty much what I've just talked about, as well as suggestions for the next steps. So how did we get to this initial report? And why is it important to review the current policy? Well, there have been increasing demands for more detailed information, and Jeff and I were talking briefly about this before the session. So people in particular, and then by people I mean people like me, are requesting more specific geographic information. There have also been changes in OMB race ethnicity categories, as well as the availability and use of national HIV data. All of these things have prompted HCPHE to review the current data release policy. Reviewing and updating this policy will have several benefits. Namely, given the long length of time since the state agreements were updated, it is likely that the local data release policies have changed. Additionally, new state and local staff may not be aware of the previous agreements and procedures and will benefit from renewing these agreements and becoming more familiar with the CDC policies. Finally, review of the existing data policy release will help as we develop guidance for state and local health departments' presentation and display of geographic information. So there's a lot of interest now in GIS and public health data and mapping, and so they're really, we all are working to develop some guidance for around that. So at this point, we've submitted our findings, which include considering a rule that uses a denominator rule and is supplemented with a proportion, and the proportion we're looking at is 10%. So that's where we are right now. We're leaning towards a denominator rule and then supplementing that with a proportion. In order to evaluate the feasibility, we used HIV surveillance data and current census data and examined what sort of threshold rule allows for distributing the data in the most useful form while still protecting privacy and ensuring confidentiality. And so we have been in this work group now for a year, maybe longer, meeting every other week for an hour. And so we have reviewed the literature and we have discussed this topic, and it's been really fascinating to be part of it. We've looked at census data and surveillance data and at all kinds of scales and levels and denominator rules. And so there's really been a lot of work that's gone into this, I guess is what I'm trying to say. We started at the national level. So we started looking at census data at the United States level, like if how many of a particular subpopulation, what's that smallest denominator? Then we looked at the similar type of thing at the state, the MSA, and the county. We actually really haven't gotten to county yet. But we've looked at the other scales. To inform the choice of denominator thresholds, our census guru generated files containing the most recent intercensal population estimate for each combination of the variables you can see on the slide. So we were using 2007 HIV data, so we wanted to use 2007 census data. So he's generated countless census files with the many, many different combinations of these different variables here. And these files are being used to determine this threshold rule. And we're currently, by currently I mean this week, next week, last week, in the process of summarizing our initial analysis of the census data and making recommendations. So it really is a work in process, and we're making progress, which is always a good thing. So just in conclusion, I just want to reiterate that there's a history behind the small cell rules and data suppression, so the literature is out there. As discussed, the geospatial community has developed additional methods for protecting sensitive data. As I just mentioned, that policy, our data release policy, is a work in progress. And the hope is that findings may contribute to development in other branches or to overarching DHAP or center policies. And here you'll see. Well, really you don't, but And I didn't mean for people to be able to read this anyway, but if you're interested in this literature, I put it up so you can. I can give you my email address, and I'm happy to email you all these different references. But this is just a small list of some of the more well-known work on statistical disclosure assessment and limitation. And then these are some of the spatial resources that I reviewed as well. So again, I'm happy to send these out to interested folks. And then finally, I just wanted to, as Donna did, acknowledge our partners in this project, as well as Pat Sweeney, who reviewed the last segment of my presentation on the data release policy. Okay, thank you.